CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 175, with Dr. David Smadja. How AI, nanotech, and startups are transforming ophthalmology, and here's how you can get started too.
Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast. And today I've got a very special guest who's going to teach us a whole lot. And that is Professor David Smadja. Welcome to our podcast, my friend.
Hey, Dave. Very happy to be part of this podcast. You know, for me, it's a big milestone in my career now.
Oh, you're very sweet. You know, I've learned a lot from you over the years, a lot. You're super innovative. You think very differently. But give everyone a background of how you even got into ophthalmology.
So actually, it's funny because my brother probably got me here in ophthalmology because of his refraction.
Okay.
He's the only one in the family with glasses, and he has a very high hyperopia.
Oh, interesting.
So yeah, like he's about +9 and -3, you know, diopters, and of astigmatism. And so when I was thinking about what to do, I always love, you know, physics and optics. And I always kept into my mind to find something in medicine to help my brother. So naturally, I went to ophthalmology.
Well, yeah, obviously to refractive surgery.
Yeah, exactly. And I still didn't find, you know, a way except, you know, refractive lens exchange for him, which is a great solution. But part of my journey, you know, in a innovation was to try to find something else for him. But now he's getting too close to refractive lens exchange. He's already, you know, 45 years old, so he's going to get there before I find something for him.
Right. No, I think I agree with you. I think for a high hypo, in the USA, we're a little bit more limited because fewer things are FDA approved. But I think, yeah, the best solution is probably contact lenses until you're of presbyopic age and then refractive lens exchange.
Exactly. He's, you know, equipped with a contact lens for, you know, for the past 30 years. And now he's getting presbyop. So far he still has some accommodation. So I'm pushing him to wait a little more. But you know, it's gonna probably get there soon.
Well, it's interesting. As longer we wait, again, more and more IOL options become available.
Yeah, that's true. That's why I'm not in a rush. And he has a very good tolerance to contact lens as well. I think he's still in a good situation. At least he took me in ophthalmology, so. Oh, just for that, I am thankful.
Very thankful. And so you've done a lot of pioneering work here in refractive surgery in particular, especially corneal refractive surgery.
So I get a great mentor that was thinking, you know, very creatively. And I remember when I was fellow at the Cleveland Clinic with Ron Kruger.
Sure.
Back then, he just got a Galileo device there. It was pretty new, you know, like 2 years on the market, and no one was, you know, were really using that. And so he told me, if you want to build your name, find, you know, a device and start to make a pioneer work on that. And I found that, you know, very good advice. And we started, you know, to publish, you know, a lot of article on that specific device. And that the way, you know, we started to think about topography and the way to analyze the cornea, and new stuff came up with that. I had a great team of fellows, by the way, at that time, with Marconi Santiago, which is a very close friend to me and was my co-fellow. You know, he taught me how to do some gym and stuff like that as well. So we had a great time. And I think that's how we started to think creatively and trying to find new stuff and to get into a new equipment and start to see how it works. And that was, you know, I thought it was very useful and very good to start your career. So that was very helpful.
Yeah, that's great advice for a young ophthalmologist, is focus on something very, very specific and develop a very deep expertise in something very narrow.
Exactly. You know, this is something that we do with my former fellow, where we find something where we kind of felt ourselves a little bit frustrated. He was my fellow in refractive surgery, and by chance, he was also a computer scientist.
Okay.
So that was, you know, the best profile ever for me. So and we were frustrated with the issue of the epithelium and the impact of the epithelium on the refraction of our patient where they were coming for retreatments. And so by discussing with him, I started to tell him, you know what, you are a computer scientist. Let's develop something, you know, to model that epithelium and get the refraction of the epithelium for any type of, you know, device. So you just get the JPEG of any type of or PDF or any type of OCT people have out there, and try to modelize that in a 3D and then get the refraction from that. And I told him, if you can do that, you will be able to create a tool for the whole refractive surgery community and build your name on that. And that's what he did over the past 2 years. He developed, in parallel to his clinical activity, he developed that tool, and then we set this software company, and we are doing a lot of great stuff now. And we do not intend, you know, to do everything, but just to create a tool for people, you know, to make the rest of Pioneer work on that. But at least we have a tool now to start to assess different things with the epithelium. So that's very cool.
So when we're looking at cornea now, Sophia, advice you'd give for a young surgeon who's, let's say, interested in corneal refractive surgery, what should we look for in the cornea? It's everything now. You're looking at the epithelium. You're obviously looking at the anterior cornea. We already know so much is important with the posterior cornea. How do we figure all this out?
So, you know, my way of seeing this very little window, it's optically wise. I try, and that's how I fell into that, you know, epithelium, because sometimes you remove this and optically everything's changed. So that's how we started to focus on that. But the way I'm usually seeing a patient most of the time, this is because of my background also, it's in terms of optics. You know, optics is something that we all need to understand a patient. Patient is coming with a complaint, which is a clinical complaint, but you can translate that into optics, you know.
Sure.
And many times you find something you can fix or try to solve and get better. And sometimes you can, the optics looks good and the things become really purely medical. You know, the retina is not, does not function the way it is. But even cataract is an optical problem. You know, it's transparency. Sure. So usually the way I teach that is to think in terms of optics and of geometry. So it makes things for a little simpler for my fellows and my team to relate to a cornea when they see scars, when they see some complaint of the patient, and trying to connect what the patient is complaining about and the shape and how it will bend the light after that and why the patient is complaining so much. That is very helpful. And it makes this organ fantastically interesting.
Well, for sure. So what are the best ways in 2026 for us to identify very early stages of form-frus keratoconus?
So that's I think it's we are living in a very exciting time in terms of detection of early disease, and it's obviously much easier for me to speak, you know, after all my peers working hard on many directions than it was for someone 20 years ago. So I'm kind of lucky here, but I think that the topography is well understood, that it is, you know, the tip of the iceberg. You know, it's like when everything is already out. And biomechanics was very exciting back to 10, 15 years ago, but it's still something that we could not find any reliable way of measuring the biomechanics. And I think we should probably jump and go to the steps before biomechanics and probably dive into the world of biomarker, because I think it's a wonderful world, and we have people like Roy Chetty and Pooja Kamar that are doing amazing stuff on that specific topic about biomarker. But I think that's probably the signature of many things we are looking in medicine, and trying to understand what will create this weakness in the cornea. And in parallel to that, I think we need today to, you know, connect AI to everything we are doing. This is what people are doing to create new drugs today. We can do everything in a much simpler way. So even when we were trying to think about a molecule, today AI can, you know, catalyze everything, 10 years of work into a 1 year of single analysis. So I think connecting AI with the world of biomarkers and some molecule that can help to profile our patients will probably be the best way to go in the next decade.
Well, it makes a lot of sense because the old way of thinking was so late in the game. We would think, okay, let me wait until I see a problem on topography. But as you're saying, then even before that, you'd have issues with biomechanics. But even before biomechanics, you'd find biomarkers.
Exactly.
So let's get back to the biomarkers, which obviously, if you have bad biomarkers, now down the road, you'll get biomechanical problems. And then years later, now you get topography changes. So let's not wait to the end.
I think biomechanics for sure will find something. But yeah. I think it's kind of the step that is coming after biomarker. So we should probably focus our effort on biomarker, which is what many people are doing now. And by the way, the other things, because I'm giving a lecture next week on the detection of keratoconus yielding epithelium. And it's interesting to see the shift. We're discussing that between, you know, those hard cutoff that you can have sometime. And we learn the cutoff, you know. You sit in front of corneal topography and you have that, you know, 47.2 diopters being suspicious, you know, that we all learn. And so we were educated with cutoff, and it's the same for everything. You know, fever is a cutoff. You know, when do you have fever and when you do not have fever? So we kind of live with values, and the world is actually much more predictable with pattern than with values. So that's something I'm trying to teach always to my fellows. Do not stick to values. And many times they are coming with topography. Look at that. It's 48.5. We shouldn't touch this patient. And it doesn't mean anything. Numbers, it's number. It's part of a research, a sample. And pattern is something else. And when I was looking at pattern in other field, like astronautics, for instance, I fell into that disaster of the space shuttle Challenger, you know, in 86. And everything was related to single metrics, like a lower temperature. They knew it was like something that might be suspicious. And it changed everything after the many people started to look around and look what happened at the NASA at this time. They started to change and develop a lot of different monitoring around patterns. And I'm talking to you about 40 years ago. So right. I think we should definitely change our mind and think in terms of pattern.
Yeah, as opposed to just absolute strict number cutoff.
Yes, yes. You look at the topography, by the way, your mind is trying to translate something you see, which is a pattern, it's not a numbers, right, into numbers and put that in one single categories. But we pattern is a trend, is connection between variable, is something that is moving over time. So I think it's that's the way we need to find new way of measuring pattern and following pattern. That's to me one of the message I have for detection, any type of detection.
This is where you're coming in with your AI ectasia risk models now.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We do that with the epithelium. We do that with, I was doing this with the parameter I had, but today I'm trying to kind of find that the epithelium might be one of the clue for helping us to get some pattern, because keratoconus, when it changed, modified the epithelium. We all know that. And we try to look at the thinning of the epithelium. But this is, again, we're falling into the same, you know, mistake that we were doing. What is the number of thinning and you know, how thin is the cornea here? How thick is there? But the pattern itself is changing. And a way we find to measure the pattern is the refraction. So when you measure the refraction around the cone that try to compensate, then we see this huge hyperopic shift, and we could correlate that hyperopic shift around the cone if you measure that. And so instead of saying, you know, it went from 54 micron to 53 micron, which is exactly standard deviation, you know, of the OCT. So here we're talking about the whole shape of the epithelium changing, trying to remodel itself to, you know, mask the cone that is progressing. And so we have something fantastic here that we can appreciate differently. And the way we are measuring the refraction, we can see a very nice trend toward a more hyperopic epithelium as long as the disease is progressing. So that's, I think, it's something that might probably improve some sensitivity a little bit there.
That makes a lot of sense. So this is your EpiMaster software. Tell us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. That's the whole thing. It's the idea is to become a master of the epithelium and trying to answer a lot of different questions. As many things in innovation, it started with a very frustrated, case. I had a patient, obviously a physician, that's always, the patient that got complicated. And it's a gynecologist that came to me for enhancements. Very easy guy came for a -2. I treat him -2, and the patient ended up to be +1.75. Like, what happened?
Yes. We've all seen this. It's so frustrating.
And so I was very frustrated. Obviously, I was doing a lot of surgery to physician in my hospital. So it's also like very uncomfortable to have someone, and that's horrible. Someone, it's nearly 40 years old, and you take him to a +1.75 diopters of refraction. That's the worst. So I started to think about what happened. And looking back at his epithelium, which is something I was not doing a lot 8 years ago, you find yourself with like a big bump, red bump of epithelium, which is a very hyperplasic epithelium. And when I try to slice this in 3D, in my mind, you finally find yourself with, like an epithelium that looks like a plus lens, very convex lens, with about 20 micron of, the, it's a very nice heart.
Then in the center then, and then coming out to the...
Yeah, so we have a gradient of about 20 micron in the center. And when I apply just like this, like a Mineraline formula on that for 6 millimeters, it was like about -2 diopter of myopia. And I say, what? So that's why I started to think about this more and more. And then I find my, I tried to, the journey was a little long, but then when I had my fellows, I was trying to make some nomograms from that and trying different things, like to remove the epithelium, refract back my patient, a lot of different things. And then when I had my fellow that was also a computer scientist, I told him, we need to find a way to measure that because I'm getting crazy with this. Those patients are having a very poor outcome. And since then, we are building a nomogram for retreatment. We are creating some simulator inside the software. So tomorrow, when you do PTK or when you do, irregular cornea with a very fine epithelium, you can subtract and get a vectorial, a subtraction from what you have, the refraction of your epithelium and the refraction of your patient. So it can get things, more predictable. And that's exactly where we want to go. Obviously, a lot of work needs to be done now on that. Probably big data will help. Because one of the main question is always, what will happen to the epithelium next? The way it will grow back. But this is, big data. So I'm happy just to give that, clue, that tool for the community and hope people will do a great job with that too.
So you think of the epithelium as actually an extra refracting surface.
Oh, it is. It is. We all experience that in our refractive surgery, because you think of a patient with this refraction, then you remove the epithelium, you treat something, but it's you already changed the refraction without knowing that. Right. And then you get a completely unexpected refraction. So the first study actually that we did, one of the work we did is, and we presented that I think 2 years ago in ASTRES, was to take all the patient that had completely unexpected refraction. So the patient comes for -5, you treat him like any other patients, and suddenly the patient comes back with -1.5. like, you know, what happened?
Yeah.
So we could collect over the year about probably 20 patients like this, 20 eyes. And when we ran our software to see what was the epithelial refraction, at the time we were seeing that surprise. So patient is coming with that -1.5. I was looking at the epithelium was like -135. And for all the patient, it was about 90% of the refraction that was not expected was the refraction of the epithelium. So we started to say, what? That we have something here. 90% of what was not supposed to happen is the epithelium. So we started to analyze that a little more. And then you see that very nicely in cataracts. You know, when you do cataracts, what are the patients with the lowest predictability? Keratoconus, patient.
Yeah, irregular corneas, yeah.
Exactly, all irregular cornea. And when you look at them, the thing that they have in common, it's a completely different epithelium. There was a very nice paper coming up, I think, less than a year ago from Gatinel, which is one of the master of optics. By the way, I learned so much from him, from this guy too. And so he described the model that is called the three surface model. You know, we're seeing the cornea as one single surface, mm-hmm. and then the posterior surface, and we started to improve our biometry and IOL calculation prediction error. And then you start to think about the epithelium as a refractive surface for irregular cornea, because it makes sense. The refraction of that epithelium is completely different than in any, you know, normal or virgin cornea. And for those patients, you see that surface really act as a real refractive surface. So it's three surface model. And this is something that is actually very hot to me. If you ask me what will happen in about 2 years or three, I think that third surface model will probably be a part of our calculation.
Yeah, we've all seen it. I mean, I've had my own patients, when you gave your example, where they have a little bit of irregular cornea. I had a patient with radial keratotomy, had IOL surgery, ended up -1 and was not happy and wanted to be Plano. Well, I made the mistake of just doing, okay, I'll just do a little bit -1 PRK, so easy. And then the problem is that you said, now they end up +1.5. Like,
that's the worst. Exactly. Yeah. So we build a mammogram for that. But you know, it's very interesting, because that's the history of innovation.
Yeah.
When you think about that, this is exactly the case to tell you that we need to do something. And so we all experience that, but you know, we don't speak with each other about, you know, usually failures. This is something you want to keep for yourself. And so, you know, there is this joke, this Jewish joke that I love. It's like someone that is, you know, religious, that is praying. And because he's saying that he's praying, he's like in the middle of the water, and the water is of the sea, and the sea is going up. And the guy is saying, no, it's fine. I'm praying. Nothing will happen to me. And there is a boat coming. And the boat is saying, come fast. You know, the water is coming up. No, it's okay. No worries. I'm with God and I'm praying. It's fine. And then a second boat is coming. You know, the water is here. And the guy said, oh, no worry. I'm okay. I don't need to come. I'm praying. Nothing will happen to me. And the guy drowned. And then he went to the sky and see God and say, but God, I don't understand. I was praying all the time and you kill me? He said, man, are you crazy? I sent you two boats and you didn't take anything. So it's like, you know, we have sometimes some message from our patients trying right. to find a solution. We can pass, and it happened to us again and again and again. Right. We can say, wait. Now we need to do something, because it happened to me. It obviously happened to other people. So we need to, you know, do something now and find a solution and solve this. So it's a very exciting stuff, but it's a way of, you know, things in life. And I think innovation is very nice, and it's a very exciting ecosystem to experience. I love it.
Especially now when we can share the data. Mm-hmm. When we get to the era of big data, can replace the old dogma we had in the past, because now you can pool such amazing amounts of data together.
Yeah, it's you know that we have a lot of residents. I remember myself, I think I published my first paper when I was, you know, a fellow. I was trying to publish my first paper, and then I started my research fellowship. And today I see the residents. There is this library of data that people can share, and they make a lot of they are running AI on those data from around the world, and they make, you know, like thousands of articles on that. So it's another generation, but it's great. Big data can break some myths, and I think it's also very good.
Yeah, I think so too. I think especially as we're getting in the incorporating of AI into these projects, you know, we had a project, the group I'm working with, of using AI in lens calculations. And that's really become like a game changer. Certainly the next generation of these formulas, whether it's corneal refractive or it's IOL-based surgery, they're all going to incorporate this to a very large degree.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I'm convinced. I think, you know, today you are writing email with AI, you are reading your email with AI. So there is no reason why we won't calculate IOL with AI. We just need, you know, robust data. That's the only thing. Data is key. But I think tomorrow the AI could definitely find a better way to homogenize data and find the source of data in a better way.
Now, let's talk a little bit about innovation and kind of entrepreneurship, because you have a lot of innovations and you have a very strong entrepreneur spirit. How do you get this? And then how do you teach this to your fellows?
So first I grew up in France, and then I moved to Israel about 10 years ago. And like in Israel, you know, having a startup, it's like, you know, having a dog. It's like everyone has a startup. It's like a part of the normal life here. So I remember my first week in Israel, I was having a coffee, and I was here with my phone, and I was looking for a place to charge my phone. And I asked a guy on the coffee right next to me, and I told him, hey, do you have a charger? And the guy said, no, I don't have. Okay. And after 5 minutes, the guy looked at me and said, imagine if we had a table where you put your phone and you have the energy of the sand that will, you know, charge your phone. And I was thinking, well, that's crazy. People are always thinking here about, you know, something that will solve some problem with the company. So there is a culture here of taking an idea and go to a product. And so you see so many people doing this. And you say, oh, that looks simple. So let's start. Okay. And there is an ecosystem that is actually making this easier, because you have a lot of grants. You have the National Innovation Authority that is providing you, you know, early funds for a project. For EpiMaster, the same thing, for instance. So we can get some money for, you know, just with your idea. So that's that makes the first steps a little easier to convert an idea into a first book, you know, proof of concept. And that is completely different. And so I gave a presentation, I think probably 4 years ago, about the innovative, you know, innovation journey. And I call something the innovator test, you know, the how would you pass that first test? Because I think we all had a lot of idea over the past 10 years, but there is this first switch of how to take this idea and to go to the next step.
Sure.
The next step, things are becoming a little easier because you initiate things. So that's a little bit different. But the first things, you have so many, you know, a voice in your head saying, oh, it's not your profession, or, you know, maybe you should not share that because someone will steal that. It's fine, but you will die with that. So you know, like you won't do anything with this. So the odds of, you know, someone stealing your idea versus someone, you know, giving you a good contact is toward, you know, that people that will be very helpful for you.
Sure.
So I usually, when I have an idea, I speak about that all the time. It makes crazy my lawyers and IP, you know, attorney and stuff. But there is way to do that. Obviously, you don't just say, oh, I think this is going to be the next big things. But you should talk about an idea, share that, because we all are very busy. One time I was talking to the head of Microsoft Incubator here about an idea of software that I have. And at the same time, I was talking to him about that. I was thinking, because the guy is, you know, running an incubator for Microsoft. So who is better than him? But at the same time, I was thinking, ah, I'm crazy. I'm talking to the guy that in just like this can steal your idea and make, you know, a lot of money right out of it. And I told him, why you won't steal my idea? You know, like I'm talking to you and I have no, you know, NDA in place, nothing. I'm just talking to you like a friend. Why you won't take that if you like it and then you put like two engineer and then tomorrow the soft is ready? And the guy said, do you really think I have someone in my whole incubator here that is getting money at 8 o'clock in the morning when he comes to work for doing nothing? Everyone has, you know, like a task and have a lot of work to do. So it doesn't work this way. And the guy helped me, put me in contact with someone else and things, you know, worked pretty nicely after that. So I think the first thing is probably really to don't be afraid about sharing your idea, because you will find a lot of people helpful there, and you will find people that don't like your idea, try to challenge that. And it's also very good because that helps you to refine your idea. Yeah. So I'm talking about the idea that I have all the time, and it has always been helpful for me, either to find the guy that will help me to translate that into a product, or to find someone to bring money, or just to refine the idea. So I usually talk about my idea and I find that very useful. So that's one of the big tip that I give to all my fellows. Don't be afraid that because you are, you know, either fellows or residents, your idea looks stupid. Usually that's the best idea.
Right.
You're a little naive. So, you know.
Right. There. Well, with the younger doctors, the residents or fellows, they're not as bound by the old dogma way of thinking. So they sometimes think very differently. That being a little bit naive is actually very helpful.
Oh, yes. Yes. You know, one of the questions I'm asking to when I give some optics course on medical students, yeah. And I always explain to them what is presbyopia. And I tell them, look, guys, there are not a lot of things that affect, you know, like half of the world population. And if you solve that, you can be very rich. And no one still solved that thing. So if someone has an idea, come to me and we're going to speak after that, you know, because they don't know anything about presbyopia. So I'm trying to find a crazy idea of someone that has nothing to do with ophthalmology. So far, it didn't work, but who knows?
Well, also important to realize that of all these ideas you have, only a small percent end up working out into something viable. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, it's worth trying them. And I think it makes your career so much more exciting. I think we all have those colleagues that are great surgeon, great clinician, but they are, you know, like blinking twice and 30 years past, you know, like they are still, you know, seeing the patient doing surgery and I think combining that, and they probably along the way they probably had, you know, tons of idea that could have been, you know, a real game changer in the field. So I think it's not only change the game, it also change your own life, career, make it a little more spicy and very nice. And this is another ecosystem that is worth, you know, knowing and seeing those people that are around and inventing the medicine of tomorrow. So that's to me, it's something that is very worth getting into it.
No, absolutely. I think it's great ideas. Now tell me about your nanodrops. When I first heard of this, I thought, what a genius idea. And explain to the ophthalmologists who are listening who don't know, what is nanodrops?
So nanodrops started with a very simple idea of putting drops to correct the vision. So I was working one day and I had some headaches, and I kind of understood that I probably had a little hyperopia.
Okay.
And I didn't want to have those glasses with just, you know, plus a half or plus one. So I was thinking maybe just having drops to refresh my eyes and see better focus would be good. And the idea starting like this, so I called one of the guy I was working with, an engineer, and asked him, do you think we can, you know, have drops that change the refractive index of the tear film? And so he told me, let me think about it, but everything is possible in engineering. So, you know, I flew back to Israel, and the guy told me, you know, I have an idea of how to make it work. And the idea was to have a drawing on the cornea, and that drawing will be activated by eye drops. Okay. It can be different type of molecule. Today we have different type of molecule that we design. And those molecule is basically blocking the light at specific location. And so it build another focus, or it create extended the focus. And the nice thing is that it's a low invasive procedure that is reversible. So it's like for us, it's a kind of peace of mind. You know, when we think about presbyopia, we always have the multifocal IOL or, you know, other type of stuff, but it involves some decision making that most likely will be not reversible, or reversible at the cost of another surgery that might be dangerous. So now we have a very low invasive, very easy to perform. That is, can be temporary. We can simulate that very easily on a contact lens and show you how you will see after that. We don't need any other, you know, if anything like a digital simulation, we can. But it's like very easy to make that drawing and show you exactly the way you will get your new focus. The distance vision remain the same, with just at a cost of a 20% decrease in contrast. And this is for presbyopia. This is exactly where we are. We're in about 2 months, we're going to do the first patient with that. So we are very excited about that. But we have that for everything. So the drawing can be for myopia control, by for, you know, many things. So it's another, a new way of correcting refractive error, basically. You know, we know glasses, we know contact lens, we know laser surgery that we shape cornea, and here it's another concept. So that's a very cool thing. So
yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, there's so many different kind of ideas now, right?
Yeah. So, you know, I think it's always nice to get people that are, you know, living in the world of optics that sure. are not clinical optics. And then they say, oh, but why you never tried that?
Right.
I don't have answer for you. And then when you try, things seems to be, you know, simple, easy. So that's where we are now. We are after 6 weeks of, six years yeah. of development. And we are now doing the first patient. So I'm very excited about it.
Yeah, all this is going to keep changing. I mean, if you look at how we used to treat the cornea, right? 30, 40 years ago, radiokeratotomy, which seems so crazy now. Then we went to PRK. Now we tried everything along the way also. We tried conductive keratoplasty, LTK, laser thermal keratoplasty. That didn't work. Now we did excimer lasers, now femtosecond lasers. Now we're going to try these nano drops. And I hear someone else is trying to just even use chemical agents to help, just instead of taking away cornea tissue, just reshape the cornea, or maybe heat, or maybe, who knows?
But you know, when you think about that, sometime when you speak with investors, they are asking you, but why would I use that instead of contact lens or any other thing? And then I usually answer them, you know, it's funny because I would love to go to the past and sit with the guy that invented contact lens and speak with the first investor. You know, today contact lens seems for us like something of the daily life. But imagine you tell someone, you say, oh, you know what, I have a crazy idea. We're going to put a foreign body in your eyes. You're going to put that by yourself at home. Don't care about infection. No worries, going to work perfectly. And do that at home yourself, you know, when you're not experienced to play with your eyes. But do that like this stack, and you put a foreign body in your eyes, you will see perfect. And so when you think about that first discussion about the contact lens, and of course, imagine the whole journey about, you know, chemicals and materials and everything from tolerance. But it happened to be one of the huge players today in the industry. Right. So you know, there is a beginning for everything. And it's we need to be confident. If you think that the science is strong behind your idea, it's a matter of strategy and chance. Obviously, things, you know, do not work without chance. So let's hope.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure the first contact lenses people said, why not just wear glasses? Why put this foreign thing in your eyeball, right? Why? So crazy.
Exactly.
And now, of course, now it's like it's a, you know, mega billion-dollar industry, and it's so commonplace.
It's crazy, exactly. So I think there are always place for another, you know, approach for a visual correction. Obviously, it needs to be simple, safe, and effective. But as soon as you align everything, I think a high chance for this to, you know, strike the market. So I really hope.
Yeah, I think we all are, especially me. I'm, you know, after age 50, I'm presbyopic for sure. I mean, I'm fortunate to be -2, which is really a blessing. But I mean, I would love to have a presbyopia solution.
That's so, and especially if you think about a presbyopia solution that is, you know, very minimally invasive and reversible.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like a wedding. And you know, and things get complicated there. It's like, you know, you have a solution that you can test before, and even if you don't like, even if your refraction is changing, instead of, you know, +1.5, you want +2, things are very easy to reverse and to redo the procedure. So it's really some kind of missing piece for me that I would love to see in my practice. And be very quiet about presbyopia solution. If someone wants something, I know I can do something to him, and I know it's very easy for me to take it out. So that's for me a crucial thing as a physician, and I really hope it will work the same way it works in optical bench and in animals.
Yeah, it just takes time and practice. We'll see.
It takes a long time. That's a huge long journey, but it's exciting. I learned a lot of things, you know, around that. We should not be discouraged by the fact that it will take a few years, because those years are very exciting. It's great. It's a great time. You know, you meet a lot of great people. You understand the industry, how it works. You know, I really learned a lot of things. It's like you discover a new world that was just, you know, in the back office, what you think was the back office, but it's a huge, you know, world. So I really enjoy that. Really enjoy.
Yeah, me too. I've also learned to embrace and enjoy failures, because every failure or every success, they're still on the same road to your final outcome. And you learn from those, and those failures aren't really failures. They're just learning experiences.
Exactly. That's one more step to the success. Exactly. You know, when I started to develop nanodrops, exactly at the same time, I had two more company that I set up, because I was, you know, thinking, wow, that's very easy. So there is another one that's called Smart, and we get some fund for that, and we get a proof of concept. And another one that I took the resident for. Something called the Medaton, you know, it's like something that was organized by the city of Jerusalem. They were like getting the hospital, and every team needed to find a digital solution for a problem. Okay. In medicine. And so I took some residents. It was like 24 hours in incubators, and then the next day you need to present. And we had a a very nice solution with some computer scientist, where you take slit lamp pictures and you run some computer vision there, and then you make the slit lamp that is probably the only tool that has never been changed in our field, you know, over the past 30 years. And now we wanted to have something that is run by AI and computer vision. And it was pretty cool. So we after this success, we set a company called iSlit. And so I had at the same time NanoDrops, iSlit, and Smart, which is, you know, the three things. And it was exactly the same time. And then we had a big strategy that invested into NanoDrops, and things completely changed. It's like, you know, like things become serious. Yeah. It's like a baby, you know, the baby at home is crying, smiling.
Yeah.
As soon as he's getting older, things are getting serious there.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, for sure.
Him differently, so we could not pursue with the two other company, and you understand exactly the level of commitment that you need to have for such project to make sure it's going to work. So that was also, you know, two failures in parallel. The IP still exists, but it's you understand that you cannot do everything with the same level of commitment, and it won't work if you don't have that. So
yeah, you've got to really focus your energies. If you spread it too thin, it's very difficult.
Exactly, exactly.
You've also done some work with optical simulations for predicting visual quality, like figuring out what eye well fits each patient best.
Yeah, you know, it's it's the same world of thing that I like, you know, optics and simulation. And by the way, you know, we're going to have the refractive challenge in Taiwan. We're going to meet in Taiwan in 2 weeks. And it's going to be very fun too. And so it's funny because it happened to be actually the challenge that was chosen by the ISCRS members that voted for that. And we had a very nice and very elegant solution that were submitted. And so one of the finalists there that's going to present in Taiwan was my resident that flew to Gatineau and became obviously a rising star since then, because they developed together a software that is amazing. And so he came back, he set the optics lab into our department. And so we can enjoy that very much, you know, the whole department. And basically we kind of understand that there is not one size fit all, you know, like the 23 diopters of monofocal IOL is not the same for everyone.
Sure.
So now we have a way to simulate how the patients will be able to see based on his optical profile before, mm-hmm. based on his cornea and how the cornea, you know, if the cornea is very flat or if the cornea is a little irregular, the ray of light will strike the lens at different position and will create another image.
Sure.
So that same IOL that we kind of think that will give that focus, that have that number of spherical aberration, is not true. So today we have a better understanding of this, and what is true for monofocal IOL is even more, you know, relevant for any type of premium IOL. If it's for a toric IOL, for EDOF, for instance, you know, you can take an EDOF lens and it can become a monofocal lens inside the eye of someone just because of the corneal optics. You know, sure. The corneal optics will cancel the EDOF because it will be the opposite way around. Then you just will have a monofocal lens. So that's, you know, fantastic thing, very exciting stuff, but that help us to better predict and to be less surprised after cataract surgery in some patients. The level of sophistication of the IOL today are so high that we need to understand exactly to who it will fit better. Otherwise, you just simply say, oh, the IOL is not working the way they are pretending it is. So we really need to understand that's combination of cornea and IOL together So we'll better predict our outcome and we'll be able to make better choice for our patients.
Well, there's so much variability. Like you were saying, not only the same IOL on different patients is going to give different outcomes, not just because of the cornea, but even we don't take into account pupil size.
Yeah,
it's exactly. So important for these lenses, and we're not even discussing this.
Exactly. So pupil size is a huge and very, you know, significant parameters in every simulation. Can change everything. So yeah, that's you know, we have an approach in our center, and it's also because we have the chance of having the laser institutes inside the department. So it's very cool. You know, we have like the whole department, and we have the laser institute inside. So every patient coming to cataract, and we see that he has a fanny cornea with very irregular type of cornea, he can make a first stops at the laser institute, get his cornea regularized, and then we send him back to the cataract department for, you know, reevaluating which lens will fit better for him. And we have a way also to simulate that better today with the lab. So we kind of feel that we can provide a better, we are more confident with our patient that we were before, by knowing better the optics of the lens, by being able to fix the optics better. And so we open, you know, different opportunity for IOL. If the patient was just for monofocal, now he can probably get EDOF if the cornea is better. So there is a different thinking. Obviously, it required to have a facility for that, but I think it's worth considering fixing the optics first and then doing cataract for irregular cornea.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. The tough part is, though, is getting patients to agree. Because they're coming to see you, they want just cataracts. You say, no, you got to do two procedures. First, let's treat and regularize your cornea. Then after a few months, now we'll do the IOLs. That's the hard part.
So that's very true. One of the way to overcome that I'm doing with one of the private center is to create an insurance for the patient. It's like the patient is, you know, when you book a travel agency, you can pay an insurance in case, you know, for cancellation or for any type of things. So here what we do sometime is actually not to fix before, but to fix after, is that do your cataract surgery, but you can pay an insurance fee. And if you pay that insurance fee, you will have your laser vision correction enhancements for free after that, which is, you know, included in the insurance fee. And so it works pretty well. And especially when you do premium IOL and you have multifocal IOL and the patient has a little refraction after that that is off target, then he can have his enhancements. So it provides more confidence to both the patient and the surgeon. So sometimes the surgeon himself didn't want to put any premium IOL because he was like a little, you know, anxious about the outcomes for toric or for a multifocal. And suddenly he's okay. You know what? I have my insurance maximum. He will do the treatment in the laser center after that. It's part of the insurance. So this is something that that we put in place, and it's pretty cool. Pretty cool.
Very interesting. Yeah. So then what are you doing? Like excimer laser based, something like, do you do PRK?
So usually when it happened, we check before. If we can do LASIK, then patient, you know, that comes for premium IOL, they prefer to have LASIK after that. So we check them before to see their suitability to which procedure they can do. Because if they pay the insurance and then they are not good candidate for a laser after that, it's like, you know, what you did there. So usually we check before. Then we provide an answer, and then they can, if they want, they can decide. If it's irregular cornea, obviously it will be a PRK, and usually it's transepithelial PRK with some topoguided if it's very too much. But if it's just for a refractive residual level, then it's we prefer to LASIK so patient can enjoy, you know, the next day or two.
Yeah, it's much quicker recovery then.
Yeah.
And so in those eyes, let's say you have some questions about the calculations, then it would make sense, if you're planning on doing the LASIK afterwards anyway, always choose the higher IOL power, so they end up a little myopic, because I'd much rather do a little myopic ablation.
Yes, exactly. That's part of the strategy. I'm always telling them, if you guys are not sure about which IOL to take, please don't get into hyperopic, because for me that will be so easier to treat, you know, for myopic. So that's a great comment. This is exactly what we do.
Yeah, well, you know what, I do it. I have a retina colleague who I send patients to who have no zonular support. So these patients, he's doing a sutured lens or Yamane to the sclera, so sclerofixated lens. I always tell him an IOL power at least one or two diopters higher, because right. when you put the lens in the eye, you can never figure out the effective lens position. And then also there may be a little tilt to it. So then afterwards, 3 months after the surgery, they come to me and they're minus one with minus 75 of astigmatism. It's some accident. Easy LASIK.
Exactly. Really easy. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. When it's a plus refraction, you know, it's going to start to be tough. And sometimes those cornea has a lot of senile arcus, and the outcome are even, you know, less predictable because of the ablation rate there. So it's like that's a very good, you know, advice to all those that can combine refractive surgery and cataract, you know, go to the myopic side always.
Right. Well, I mean, especially sort of like a patient where you have to do an enhancement afterwards, and let's say they're, yeah, they're on the hyperopic side or even mixed astigmatism. If they're plus one, minus two at 90, that's not a pretty ablation.
Yes, it is not. It is not. It takes a longer time, and the patient will probably have, you know, the side effects when it's in periphery. The ablation is in periphery. Yeah. The side effect, you know, can take longer for dry eye as well. So you better watch the myopic shift.
Right. But if they ended up plano minus two at 90, that's a beautiful, clean cylinder ablation. It's so easy.
Yeah, this one is easy too. Yeah, definitely. So it's a very good combination to have in that setting.
Let me end this by talking about an initiative that you have. You want to establish kind of a complications committee across all refractive centers. So you want to make sure no patient's abandoned, hopefully prevent some of the negative social media narratives that end up damaging refractive surgery.
Yeah, you know, it's one of my, I've been, I'm still for the next month, but the president of the Israeli Society of Refractive Surgery. And one of the things I really wanted to have during that mandate is to unify all the refractive center. You know, Israel is a small country, and so we have a few brands that have different center all across the country. But at the end of the day, what makes the most damage to the field is social media. Today, if someone is, you know, writing something on social media that, you know, he killed my eyes with the LASIK surgery, you know, everything can happen. We all know that those surgery are the safest, you know.
Sure.
But we, if we show the patients that we do care, you know, to their what is happening to them, and we're gonna find a solution, and we see it all together. We have we set in place a day where every center can bring his most challenging patients, and the physician, we are a group of, you know, like 12 experts. We bring them to a hospital, and the 12 experts are examining them, and after that we sit and we decide how to treat them. If we think it's very complex things, you know, after a very specific procedure, we can even take some advice from abroad through a specialist or, you know. And at the end of the day, we treat them. The patient doesn't have to pay anything. The center itself is paying the physician. But at least the patient feels that he's not abandoned and someone takes care of him. So we will see just in the future if it's something that can calm down a little bit, you know, the tone on the social media. But I think it's an initiative that I really wanted to have, so we can make the patient feel that they are not abandoned by the medical community. So
I think that's a great idea. I think obviously US is a lot bigger, but it'd be great to start that same thing here. I think it'd be great.
I think when it's a brand, it's probably works nicely, but US obviously it's huge, but probably by state, I don't know. But you know, we all see those patients that comes and start to talk badly about another physician, which is your friend but works in another place. So usually I'm always starting to say, look, you know, it can happen to everyone. This happened to me, and then that can happen tomorrow to someone else. But we're here to fix. So now let's start to think, you know, in terms of solving the problem. And I think it will probably contribute positively to the field.
Yeah, I hope so. I think I hope we can see a growth in refractive surgery. So like in the U.S., refractive surgery numbers are pretty flat, maybe even slight decline over the last few years. But the amount of myopia in the population is like increasing rapidly.
It's weird. It's hard for me to understand why there is this decline for, you know, except during the COVID where, you know, sure, we started to see a peak. But the surgery is so, you know, it's so successful.
Right.
So obviously not everywhere. We need to make sure that, you know, people are well trained for that. But social media is not doing great stuff about that most of the time. So.
At least not yet. We'll work on that though. We've got time. Well, David, I want to thank you. We've been talking for a whole hour already. It's so easy to chat.
Yeah, that was great. It was great, Uday. Thank you so much for that invitation. You are doing fantastic things for education. You know, we all learn from the cataract coach. So for us, you know, I'm talking about the whole refractive and cataract Israeli community. You know, we're all big fan of what you are doing.
So, oh, thank you. Yeah, we as you know, we all learn together. I learn more than I teach, I promise. All right. I want to remind our listeners and viewers, remember, we've got a new Cataract Coach podcast every Sunday on Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google. Wherever you find a podcast, of course, you find the Cataract Coach podcast. And of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every single day. We're at 3,000 days in a row and counting. So until next time, I'll catch you later.